Well, hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am so pleased because I have one of my most favorite guests in the whole world. Bradley Coates is back. He's a lawyer extraordinaire. Hello, Brad, all the way from beautiful Honolulu.
Hello, Diana. And what do you mean one of your most favorite guests? I thought I was your most favorite guest.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm trying to be a little more diplomatic. Well, you're in the top two or three. And
I'll settle for that.
And you've also been a more frequent guest than I think anybody I've had because you were on my radio show when I was in Hawaii numerous times, starting in 1999 when your wonderful book, Divorce with Decency, first came out, first edition. Now you're in your fourth edition.
Aren't we, though? And going for number five, I think.
Oh, that's great, Brad. That's
great.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Now, you have a blurb on the back from a retired judge. He says, this is far more than just a divorce book. It's an all-encompassing survey of love, marriage, and romantic relationships in modern life. And also, I think it's so interesting that you travel the world and often lecture on cruise ships on marriage preservation pointers. And can you tell our listening audience some about that before we get into some aspects of your book having to do with ingredients for a healthy and lasting relationship? So
sure.
What happens when you go on a cruise ship and you lecture? I know one time you ran into my mother.
she was delighted.
I
lecture for Princess Cruises, which calls itself the Love Boat. In fact, they did the Love Boat series, and I can tell you for a fact that nobody wants to hear about divorce on the Love Boat. So
mm-mm.
I actually have kind of flipped it around and do a series of talks about, you know, kind of these hokey titles about a divorce lawyer's guide to preserving your marriage, but it really is true. I mean, I can tell some more stories about how when things, you know, what I've seen go wrong in relationships, and I can give people, you know, kind of advice for what maybe is going to make them more likely to go right. So I've done probably 25,000 divorces in this. So the Coates and Frye firm that I run in Honolulu is the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii, and we've probably done 25,000 divorces over the last 35 years. So I've learned a little bit about what makes people tick in relationships, and you and I have discussed it, and we'll again discuss it today. And I talk about it on the cruise ships, and it's been pretty popular for 15 years I've been doing that.
I think it's great, and I take, well, you've given me a little credit for sort of coaching you to go in that direction to talk about marriage.
I've given you a lot of credit. I cite you in my book, and you really were. You know, it's interesting. You start out as a divorce lawyer just with this sort of meat axe down the middle, divide up people's property and affairs and relationships and kids,
yeah.
And you know, and then you begin to. You know, that gets a little overwhelming after 30-plus years of doing it, and you begin to try and look for some of the rationale for behind why people behave they do, and it gets more interesting to talk about the psychology, et cetera, of relationships rather than just doing another, like I say, meat axe down the middle property division. So you were instrumental in getting me to think that way, so I appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you, too, and as you can probably tell, Brad and I are also friends, and we were when I lived in Honolulu, and we are now, and Brad, I know his wife, and he knows my fiancé, and it's all just very chummy. It's very nice, very nice. We have fun.
We definitely do.
Yeah.
So let's see what we can tell people about maybe having fun in their relationships.
Exactly. So you have a section toward the beginning of your book, Can Your Marriage Be Saved? And you have great quotes throughout the book. Love will break your heart, but it's worth it. So you, this is really helpful. I have referred a number of my clients to your book because you analyze the basic nature of marital conflict. And you quote a number of experts, including moi, but you start out by talking about romantic illusions, because this is a basic part of marital conflict. We have these illusions, don't we, about our mate.
Yeah, and you know, because I should back up a little bit, you know, when
we talk
about, you know, how to preserve your marriage or to ingredients for a healthy, lasting marriage, and, you know, it's really true of obviously the same things for any kind of healthy, lasting relationship. I mean, the reality of it is that in today's world, especially with these millennials, people just aren't getting married anywhere near as often as they used to. You know, we're really talking about a lot of people just deciding that they're going to cohabit and live together sans marriage certificate, and so we're, you know, obviously these things apply to any kind of long-term relationship you want to try and sustain. So it's not just marriages. For the first time in American history, as of the 2010 census, interestingly enough, there are now more unmarried American adults than there are married American adults, with about 48% being unmarried and about 52% being, 48% being married and 52% being unmarried, which, you know, when you and I were growing up, it was, everybody got married. It was like 80% married and 20% unmarried, probably. So that's a major change in society. But, you know, whether you call it a marriage or call it a relationship or shacking up or whatever you want to call it, it still makes sense to have it be a docile, meaningful kind of a commitment. So that's what we're really talking about.
Yes, we're talking about that, and I'm glad you clarified that, because we have lots of listeners who are not married but are in significant relationships. And so that's important, but romantic illusions pervade lots of people, because they come into it and they're just well. Helen Fisher talks a lot about what happens in the brain and how humans have evolved into three separate mating states: lust and romantic attraction, and then attachment. And I think, do you talk about Helen Fisher in the book? I can't quite remember.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think everybody talks about Helen Fisher.
Right, because for, probably going on 20 years now, she really came up with some original work by putting people in functional MRIs who were newly in love and who'd been together a while and looking at their brains.
Yeah, with the possible exception of Dr. Diana Wiley, she may be one of the most best-known analysts of romantic relationships in the country now.
Well, she's generous. Not me, but she. Well, of course, she. And the other difference is she has a number of books, but so she identifies that when we have lust, the craving for sexual gratification, it's largely fueled by testosterone, which is some women don't realize it's in them, too. I mean, it's about, 10 times more prevalent in men, but a testosterone.
Well, it's more prevalent in young men, but as women age, they develop more testosterone than guys do a lot of the time. It starts to convert over those hormones, as I'm sure you know. So,
yes.
Women
do well getting some testosterone replacement, and that can fuel a lot of sexual energy and general energy.
But lust, lust is, I can't tell you how many clients I get that they were literally, that was the initial attraction, was they met somebody, they thought they were tall, dark, and handsome, they just wanted them physically, and that became for men, men are hopeless that way. Men are always looking for, beauty and boobs and whatever, and youth, that is oftentimes the key initiator of a initial attraction, and probably not the smartest thing to rely on entirely, because there are a few other factors like, logical compatibility that begin to weigh heavily once the lust dies down.
Yes, and Helen Fisher talks about that as attachment, and there you get a sense of calm and peace and security that you might have with a long-term partner after the exciting but sometimes exhausting state of infatuation.
Well, infatuation can skew your other judgment. I mean, what you're really looking for is some pragmatic relationship. For if you want long term, as opposed to just hookup culture, raw romance, you need to think in terms of the logical, common sense issues like comparable family and social backgrounds, educational backgrounds, values, comparable incomes. I mean, that's why those insightful Asian cultures have always emphasized arranged marriages rather than just leaving it up to the guesswork of the couples themselves,
and especially the guesswork of young couples.
Yeah.
And you talk about that in your book, these arranged marriages. Yeah. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but oftentimes the parents have really the best interests of their offspring in mind, whereas the rest of the young people looking have these romantic illusions and the attraction, and it's probably linked to high levels of dopamine, and which is a hormone of attraction, of arousal, really. And
I can give you a good example just living here in Hawaii.
I'll have
clients that have met somebody on the mainland. They've got, they're hot and heavy, going for it. They're having fun. Maybe they're traveling or at a convention or they're doing something, and they then transfer that relationship to, well, why don't you come live with me or marry me and move to Hawaii or whatever. Hawaii is a wonderful place, but it's an acquired taste. Some people go stir crazy on the island. Some people can't blend into the island cultures. There's issues. Some people can't find comparable work to what they experienced on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Here you go trying to set up a relationship where, it was based upon, this initial attraction, but just literally the logical imperative of the geography, once it starts to settle in, may be a deal breaker. And that I see all the time, because like I say, it just moving from, from a big city to a country environment, or from the southeast to New York. I mean, some people can make that transition, some people can't. And unfortunately, you start the relationship based upon, you're cute, why don't you come live with me in New York? And, maybe the country girl doesn't want to live in New York, or vice versa. So it makes sense to sort of suss out some of the logical, practical factors in life. Who's going to be able to earn what kind of income? Who's going to be able to live what kind of lifestyle? And that's every bit as important as, how horny they made you that first night.
Indeed. And you say in your book, and this is obvious, but people need to hear it, need to read it. It really helps to know the person you marry and to really know them, to spend a little time before you commit to a marriage.
Yeah, no question. And you can go down a, sort of an interesting checklist on that. Ironically, this current push where so many people meet online may actually be a positive step forward in that direction. I mean, there seems to be studies that couples who meet online actually have a lower divorce rate and report higher levels of marital satisfaction, because they found out more about their spouse through the internet before they ever started dating him, as opposed to, again, just, he's cute and he seems to be able to hold his liquor and get up on the table with his lampshade on his head and dance, and he's a party guy, fun guy, whatever. He might be, if you go through one of these Match.com checklists and try and figure out, who's got comparable or Christian mingle or God only knows what, who's got comparable values, that may actually be a better screening process than just, who seems funny for that one night out.
Well, I think so. And of course, I have a bias about this because I met Brian over 4.5 years ago on Match.com, and then we got engaged last May, and we're very compatible. But you sent me a very interesting list from the Huffington Post, and 8 surprising and scientifically proven things that lead to a lasting marriage. And the second point was meeting online, and this was according to a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Couples who meet online have a lower divorce rate and report higher levels of marital satisfaction.
That may be true. I think, people that meet at universities and have got comparable education levels and comparable, career trajectories seem to do better. There's a lower divorce rate amongst highly educated people, amongst higher earning people. If it's a situation where there's not comparable education or they're not very well funded and as they move forward in life, and they're scraping along financially, those are triggers for divorce for sure.
Well, it creates a good amount of stress often in couples' relationships.
But there are some interesting statistics that are coming out that the higher end of society, the people that are making the big bucks, the people that have got the master's degrees and the higher education, they actually seem to be far less likely to divorce than do people that are having a tough time financially or are undereducated or whatever. Again, it may, we're always worried about this class divide that seems to be creeping into America to begin with, and that seems to be happening in relationships too.
Yes, well, and of course, if you have more money, there's more to lose in a divorce. There's that factor, I suspect, as well as higher education. We've known for a long time that more educated people tend to have more adventurous sex. So maybe it's a whole bunch of factors coming into it. Have you read that more educated people tend to be more adventurous in their sexual life?
Be more sexy? Well, like I say, I've read the statistics about them having more stable relationships. I'm not as much of an expert on sexuality as you are, but I can believe that.
Yeah. So, this 8 surprising things.
We talked about one of them was the meeting online actually seems to report higher levels of marital and relationship satisfaction.
Yeah.
And then right after that, the Huffington Post article goes to the next thing that says, great to meet online, but don't spend all your life living on social media. I guess Boston University did a study that said that the users of Facebook and social networking can be linked to marital dissatisfaction and increased divorce rates. If you overuse social networking, they had statistics that among heavy social media users, 32% thought about leaving their significant others compared to 16% of non-social media users. Again, social media, it can be great for finding out what you need to find out in life, but if you start overusing it, it turns into a distraction that maybe takes away from, normal communication. And normal communication is one of the backbones of a real relationship, especially for Wahinis. I assume your audience knows that Wahinis is Hawaiian for women. Women are into this obscure concept that guys are not too good at. It's whatever the hell communication is supposed to amount to. I'm joking, of course, but
that eye contact.
Yeah,
is important.
Women want it, and guys suck at it a lot of the time. So
I have some of my in my private practice. I have some, Seattle where I live. It has a lot of high earners who can afford my fee in their late 20s and 30s who work for Amazon.com or Microsoft or Starbucks. And a number of the couples that I see have gotten themselves, even with all their intelligence and their money, they've gotten themselves into trouble on Facebook and stalking somebody else on Facebook. And So I agree with this. Don't live on social media. I think it's dangerous. Then you have single people that pretty much are dating and only texting. They're not talking.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not hearing the tone of voice.
I'll tell you, social media has become death for in divorce cases because we divorce lawyers start pulling up what everybody's been posting on Facebook. They've separated and then they've got their new party photos out with their new girlfriends or drinking or partying, and the next thing they're losing custody of their kids because that's being introduced as evidence into court that they're not maybe a fit parent. So social media can really be a two-edged sword. Use it for what you need to research and find out, and then don't overdo it.
I'm glad you said that. I mean, we need to hear from your point of view. I see it as being very often deleterious from an emotional point of view, but we've got the legal stuff going, too. So we can come back to some of these surprising and scientifically proven things that lead to a lasting marriage. Let's go back to your book for a moment. You spend some time writing about different styles of communication, and it's so true. And a lot has been written about it, but I think people somehow are still not getting it, that as you write, men tend to focus on facts and women tend to focus on feelings. And we're kind of hardwired to be that way. And what do you see in your practice in terms of this? And you also mentioned Dr. John Gray's books, because that's what he deals with.
Well, it's been pretty well documented that, you know, literally as far as just the way the male and the female brains work, the differentiation between those two brains, you know, women have far more specific areas for speech and language on both sides of their brains. Men don't have enough corpus callosum to transfer between the two left and right hemispheres. Young girls start speaking earlier than young boys. A three-year-old girl will have twice the vocabulary of a three-year-old boy, and that, you know, that carries on all the way straight through. You know, the women use an average of maybe 20,000 communication words a day, whereas guys use maybe 7,000. You know, these are all just sort of statistics from my book, but it is an absolute fact that guys focus on just getting from point A to point B, whereas women like to, you know, to talk around things, just spend the time communicating, maybe speak more in generalities, where guys' sentences are going to be short and direct and more structured and right to the point. It just is women are going to be more touchy-feely, and guys have got to, they've got to be aware of that. And sometimes you got to pry communication out of guys, because I mean that is one of the single biggest. When I get clients coming in to my office, it will oftentimes be, if it's the woman who's initiating it, it's just this general sense of, you know, we don't really communicate. I don't think I've, in 35 years of practice and 20-plus thousand divorces, I don't think I've ever had a guy come in and say, you know, hardly ever come in and say, hey, we just don't communicate. Because guys
right.
don't place that kind of priority on it. If guys are going to initiate a divorce, it's going to be because they've found another woman that they're communicating with on the lust level again. Whereas women, you know, don't have to have outside relationships, don't have to have any real reason other than they're just vaguely dissatisfied with the level of communication. Women are much more lofty in their ideals about this kind of thing. Guys are much more base.
While we're talking about women and their brains, women tend to have a more active corpus callosum, and so it makes us female types more likely to speak up when we think something is screwy, and our brains also become flooded with the stress hormone cortisol when we're angry, which can make us feel really upset. We get more of that. Dr. Luann Brizendine, in her book The Female Brain, she says our brains interpret it as a sign that he doesn't care, which ticks us off even more, and puts him on the defensive. I mean, it has to do with our brains and our differing styles.
It's smart for people to try and figure out the difference between men and women in that sense. There's a great book called Why Men Don't Listen, great title, Why Men Don't Listen and Women Can't Read Maps by Dr. Barbara and Alan Pease. They're an Aussie couple of doctors.
Yeah.
And they delve into the scientific difference between men and women's biochemical brain structures. And it is absolutely true. The reality of it is that women communicate entirely differently than guys do, and substantially more than guys do. Guys are always just looking for a quick result answer. I mean, they just, you know, if a woman starts, you know, jabbering about, you know, vague feelings or whatever, and, you know, the guy's going, you know, what the heck's she talking about? I mean, if there's not some instant resolution to this, you know, why are we even discussing it? Whereas women, you know, they sort of want to talk around issues and kind of take them apart. It's interesting. One of the other things, going back and forth again on this Huffington list of the 8 surprising things that can lead to a lasting marriage, they talk about how smart it is to go watch movies together.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
they say that couples who regularly watch movies together tend to stay together, because they watch the films and then they come out of the movie theater and they spend 30 minutes talking about the characters' relationships, and it can shrink divorce rates by up to half. And it's almost because the conversations about the movies, characters, and relationships, you know, almost pry men into discussing thinking and talking critically about their own relationships and actually communicating on those kind of levels that the Wahinis like to communicate, as opposed to, like I say, just the kind of thing that guys want to do, which is watch an action hero blow somebody up. It's almost like you're prying the communication out of the guy by going to see these kind of movies that inspires thought-provoking conversations. And
yes.
Women love that.
Yes, and I often
and guys resist it.
I recommend going to the movies together to a number of the couples that I see, and I say a particular title, and I make suggestions as to what they might look for, and it generates conversations, and that's what we need. I also give some sort of practical advice about fighting fair, and I'll say, the next time you fight, try to take a moment to breathe in for 5 seconds and out for 5 seconds, because it can put you in a calmer state to deal with this, and it makes the guy a little less likely to block you out.
Fighting fair is absolutely essential.
Yes.
The reality of it is that blow-ups in kind of fights where you let the cat out of the bag with some smart-ass comment early on are just brutal on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You say stuff you don't mean, and then you can't retract it. I mean, there was a book by Tara Pope who wrote in The Science of a Good Marriage. She writes, the first 3 minutes of an argument are the most important, and strong marriages have at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. That means that for every mistake you make, you need to offer 5 more good moments, kind, loving gestures to keep it in balance. And that is, I mean, if you say something nasty where you expand a conflict and somebody's complaining about the fact that you didn't take out the trash, to put a banal example, but you don't take out the trash and then you, instead of just this one incident, you never take out the trash and then you expand it to you're just like your father, I see what a slob he is around. Before long, you've taken a simple thing of dumping the trash, and you've insulted the entire nuclear family and just really
yes.
and made it seem like a permanent permanent negative characteristic, and then you say stuff you don't mean, and it's impolite, and you got to apologize 5 times as often, so just don't say the negative stuff in the first place.
It escalates in the scenario that you've described. It's really, really true, and we're back to Gottman's work, because he's done research for 40 years, John Gottman, and he was the first one, I think, to come up with this 5-to-1 ratio mathematical formula. It turns out he went to MIT and got a master's in mathematics, so he's a really smart guy. And Brian and I went to one of his long weekend workshops because we were comped for it, I being a psychotherapist, so we got comped, and we found out that we were a pretty healthy couple, but he does some really fine, fine work. And I know you and I started talking about John Gottman's work, 15 years ago.
Oh, he's a real guru. And for those of your listeners who don't know Dr. John Gottman, he runs something called the Love Lab at the University of Washington, by your neck of the woods, Diana. And he contends that the single biggest factor in marital success, and I'm quoting, is a husband's willingness to accept the controlling influence of his wife, in a way almost letting her dominate the relationship. And he feels that a husband's failure to let his wife control things within a marriage is the single biggest predictor of divorce, which is not something my guy clients like to hear.
No.
But, Gottman's probably smarter than you and me put together. He's done a lot of these studies and done a very scientific approach of it. When you think about it, there's actually some common sense to that. I know from my experience as a divorce lawyer that it usually is the wife who brings marital issues to the table for discussions.
Sure.
She's almost always the one who generally sets the social and interpersonal agendas within the relationships, and more often is likely to suggest solutions for problems.
To suggest that they get a divorce, right? Women initiate divorce. So it goes all the way.
Women initiate 2/3 of all divorces in America. And, you would think it would be closer to half-half, where each half of the couple would be equally unhappy, but it's women that will actually act on it 2/3 of the time.
Yes.
Guys only about 1/3 of the time.
Yes. So on that note, we're going to go to our half past the hour break. And when we come back, Bradley Coates, lawyer extraordinaire, author of Divorce with Decency, the complete how-to handbook and survivor's guide to the legal, emotional, economic, and social issues. We'll continue our conversation when we get back from the break, so please stay with us.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley with Bradley Coates, the author of Divorce with Decency, but we're talking about preserving relationships, and I thought that we need to get on to sex a little more specifically. As you know, one of my favorite topics, Bradley. The difference.
Let's get on to sex.
Let's get on to sex. And you in your book, on page 36, talk about sexual differences. We're back to the brain here because the preoptic area of the hypothalamus, the part of the brain that makes men and women feel turned on, is, guess what, 2.5 times bigger in guys and contains twice as many cells.
And, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. That's going into my next book.
Yeah, I'll send you the quote. Well, this is from Dr. Amen. And of course, women have testosterone, but men have 10 times as much as women do. And then also, it's interesting in terms of sexuality, women have to feel comfortable and safe before our hypothalamus sends out signals that we're ready for sex. And this can take a while. And you talk about this, too, in your book, Brad, that foreplay for women is everything that happens, well, 24 hours before sex. And you don't talk about that so much, but and for some men, it's 3 minutes before insertion. So there is a difference there. But you'd mentioned that men are much more visual, and of course they are. They're stimulated with their eyes. Women tend to be more stimulated with their ears. Make love to me in my ear. I need to hear the compliments, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Guys are definitely... like I say, they're pretty basic when it, I mean, it's youth. I mean, it's guys are attracted to all the stuff that biologically hardwires them to think of fertility, you know, young, smooth skin or hourglass figure, large breast to nurse. I mean, you know, I mean, it goes back to the Cro-Magnon or I'm sure because mm-hmm. guys are just looking for young girls that are fertile. And, sometimes you're better off picking an older woman who's mature.
Well, and then you have older relationships that where you're not looking to reproduce a child, and you want the compatibility and the companionship. And for some, you know, a really hot sexual relationship for some, and that can make a huge difference to have really, really good sex.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a, you know, if you can have sensuality be a part of your existence, and it doesn't dwarf everything else, but is just sort of the icing on the cake rather than being the entire cake. You know, no question, but what, you know, marriages that have good sex, they definitely can rock. Oftentimes, people find that sex is better in second marriages, oddly enough, and that's been sort of traceable. And there's no question but what, you know, somewhere in the range of, you know, a third of the people that complain or that say they want to get divorced, they attribute lack of sexuality to it as being the cause. I mean, it is one of the main sex, money, family, those kind of issues are the biggies when people come into my office.
Yes, and you report in your book, and this is absolutely true in my experience. Oxytocin is woman's stress reliever,
correct.
And of course, oxytocin is generated by touch. The more we're touched, the more we want to be touched. It makes us better lovers. It also makes us better parents and grandparents to have a lot of oxytocin flowing.
Yeah, there's a, you know, Dr. John Gray, who's done all kinds of interesting work. You know, people are probably most familiar with his Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, but he's done a whole bunch of other stuff that talks about actual hormonal issues in his latest book, and it's pretty incredible. He wrote a book in 2010. Maybe it's not his latest, but it's the latest one that I've got. Venus on Fire, Mars on Ice, The Hormonal Balance, the Key to Life, Love, and Energy. And he points out, that couples tend to be only as happy as the woman is in the relationship, and they talk about the need to reduce the stress hormone cortisol as being one of the most important things in relationships. It's a fascinating book. The tendency now seems to be of the experts to believe that women are starting to score lower than men on tests which measure happiness overall. And it's because, you know, their increased stress in the workplace, laughing over into their love and relationships live, women are now expected to do everything.
More pressure on them.
Oh, it's brutal. I mean, the idea was that this was going to be an expansionary period for women to come into the workplace and have equal rights and equal pay and equal job responsibility. And, you know, the problem is that men aren't really great at picking up the slack on the other end. You know, women are now expected to be going full tilt boogie in the workplace environment, but when you come home, they're still doing 90%, maybe only 80%, but they're still doing a highly disproportionate percentage of the actual heavy lifting that involves raising the kids, making dinner, cleaning the house, doing all that. That's still unfortunately landing in the lap of women, and hasn't been exactly compensated for by guys picking up the slack.
I hear from some of my clients is where a woman is in that role that you just described. I'm exhausted, and sleep is so much better for me than sex these days.
Yeah. You must be talking to my wife.
No, just kidding. But yeah, I hope so. But your wife is a highly ambitious, high achiever, isn't she?
Well, one of the things I was starting to say that is definitely shifting society around is that women are out-achieving men in a wide variety of areas. Mm-hmm. They're apparently still not getting compensated overall as highly as men do, which is still the glass ceiling. But they're definitely earning more professional degrees. They're graduating at higher levels from college. They're starting to out-earn. Now if you've got an average American couple, the wife out-earns the husband about a third of the time. My wife out-earns me by about threefold, and I make fairly good money as the head of a big law firm, but she makes more money in real estate. So it is and that shifts the level, what used to be sort of a level playing field has now been shifted to where women's expectations get higher of what they're expecting out of life, increase right along with their increased success across the board. So, guys are starting to, we're dangerously close to a matriarchy of strong professional women, excelling beyond a group of slacker video playing guys, and certainly women mature faster. So you've got the situation where the guy who was the life of the party when he was in his early 20s and is still out drinking and carousing in his early 30s, and the woman has gone on to saying, wait a second, I'm tired of the wet t-shirt contest and the shot and rouge, and now I want to have a kid, and if I have a kid, I want to have a roof over their head, and I want to think about private school and education, trust funds, and guys are still out partying with their buddies. So the expectations of younger women sometimes marrying younger guys, that gets blown out of proportion pretty fast.
Yeah, women's, and then these women have many more choices if they're making a good income, and they don't want to stay with slacker guys.
Yeah,
but now it may sound like we're picking on guys, and we're not, but they're, because this is not all, obviously, this is some.
But it used to be that women were trapped in relationships. I mean, they didn't have any money of their own. They had to rely on the husband to bring home the bacon, even if they weren't happy in their relationship, they had to stay because they didn't have any life of their own. Now they've got a life of their own that's oftentimes far better than life with the guy.
Right.
After following divorce, women are far less likely to remarry and far less and take a lot longer. If they do remarry, they take a lot longer to do so than guys. Guys remarry almost instantly after getting divorced.
Yes.
And in much higher percentages. It seems to be that men, especially as they get older, men really need women more than women need men. I mean, women are fine, you know, joining their book clubs and, you know, and their little sewing circles. They've got a whole different sets of socialization with, you know, just with other wahinis that guys don't have. Guys peek out, you know, their male linkages are formed through the bonding of athletic teams during high school.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, you know, the work environment, your colleagues at work. You know, the guy retires from work and, you know, other than his golfing buddies, you know, he doesn't have the social network that the women do. And and he's sometimes not feeling as strong physically and, you know, and never learned to cook for himself and whatever. And, you know, they're pretty desperate to find a woman to take care of him again. Women are more than happy just going it alone.
That's true.
A lot
and,
of them.
And some of the older women that I see in my practice, they're very sensitive to not having the guy just want a nurse with a purse.
Yeah, great line. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's not original, but yeah. And, you know, I have a 93-year-old mother who's in pretty good shape and looks pretty good. And she lives in a very active retirement community where there are very few men, but more, and this is typical, but she's been widowed, my mom, 3 times now, and she doesn't want to remarry again, and part of it is, you know, she's got some money, but she doesn't want to be a nursemaid. She's been through that a couple of times, so.
Wow, she's outlived 3 husbands?
Well, my father was killed by a truck when I was 15, so that was, but she has outlived 2 husbands.
Wow.
The second one, it's probably the guy that you met when on the cruise. Or no, maybe it was her 3rd husband. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Hard to keep him straight.
Yeah. So, but she had to be, you know, somewhat of a caregiver to her last 2 husbands. And
I think a lot of women feel that way.
Yes.
And, you know, I think the only thing that saves the guys is demographics. There's, you know, there's fewer men of a certain age than there are women of a certain age, and you know the demographics start to work in their favor. But other than that, I think there's an awful lot of women that would just as soon fly solo.
But a lot of these women, in fact, do want some kind of closeness, sensuality, if not full sexual intercourse, but to have the sense of closeness. And I've got kind of a cute joke. Now I have my gerontologist hat on. So this woman comes in to the retirement community's television room, and there happen to be 3 old guys watching television, and she's got her hand clutched up, and she says, "Anybody who can guess what's in my hand can have sex with me tonight."
Yeah.
And one old guy looks up and says, "An elephant?" And she opens up her hand and she says, "Close enough."
I like that. I like that.
I thought you might. But there is, you know, it really, to remain sensual and hopefully sexual as we age is very good. Now I'm on my bandwagon, but I think you believe in this too. It's very good for one's health and longevity.
I'm definitely in favor of more sex. You won't get any argument out of me. So let's, because we're coming close to the end, let's go through some of these things, because, you know, the list that I got out of this Huffington Post was pretty interesting. One that we didn't talk about yet, having a cheaper wedding. Now, get this.
That's so interesting. Yes, do talk about that.
They say you may be tempted to bless your marriage with a fairy tale wedding, but according to research from Emory University, couples who have thriftier celebrations are more likely to stay together. Among female respondents, those with a wedding bill higher than $20,000 divorced at 3.5 times the rate of those who had spent only $5,000 to $10,000 on their wedding. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that never really occurred to me, and I've been doing this for a long time.
It never occurred to me either. And so did you have a less expensive wedding when you got married?
Of course. I'm a cheap guy to begin with.
I wasn't going to say that.
But, no, you know, when you think about it, the reality is probably that that's an expression of the you know, getting carried away with the romantic, you know, the fairy tale kind of thing, you know, just like when you meet somebody and go, oh, he's so handsome and he's so sexy and, you know, I just want him, without the practicality side kicking in of, you know, what's he going to be like, when he really, like I say, moves to my hometown and doesn't fit in. Maybe somebody who's more of a pragmatist and says, hey, you know, let's, you know, we're a young couple, let's keep our budget under control, that's going to be a better grounding for a long-term marriage than somebody who says, you know, I'm going to buy you a big ring and we're going to just do this flashy thing and then we're both going to go broke. I have seen marriages, I've had clients, where both of them thought they were marrying somebody who was much more affluent than they were. They were both living with leased cars, highfalutin lifestyle, running credit cards to the max, and they literally both went broke right after the marriage, after the wedding, and then at the honeymoon stage, the cards ran out, and they were expecting that the other one was going to pick up the bill from then on, and it didn't happen. They were each expecting the other one to take charge of the money. And I've handled cases like that.
They must have been just totally disillusioned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that sounds a little, you know, it sounds like a little bit of gold digging going on both sides to begin
well,
with. But it is probably not the smartest way to start things off.
No, that's right.
So on another one of the things that lead to a lasting marriage or relationship, and this is kind of interesting, respond to your spouse's random distracting comments. And they talk about John Gottman again. When your partner interrupts your reading to point out a dumb thing on the internet, they're not just trying to amuse you. They're asking for positive attention to be paid to them. And if you're constantly responding, "Not now, I'm busy," you're hurting your relationship. So Gottman studies these kind of interactions, and he finds that couples that paid attention to their partner just with the little things, just these random comments, you know, how do you like this flower arrangement, or what do you think about this, you know, news article, and you're sort of going, oh God, you know, my wife is Japanese,
yeah,
and I gotta sort of bite my tongue sometimes sitting through, you know, Japanese, you know, cultural programs, you know, on TV. We watch a lot of Japanese TV. I don't speak Japanese, so I'm sitting here going, can't we watch something that's in English? But she wants to watch Japanese stuff and then talk about flower arranging or the fallout from Fukushima or something like that, you know, and I'm going, you know, can't we move on to something that, you know, is really more interest to me? But I've learned that we talk about whatever she wants to talk about. You know the old saying, happy wife equals happy life.
Yes.
Happy wife equals happy life. And that, you know, if you do believe that the women are going to control a lot of the relationship dynamic, you know, probably smart to get with that program.
Didn't you get a version of that message from your own father?
Yes, yeah, and that's where it came from. And he was a happily married guy. He used to adore my mother. He was to always talk to the kids and say, oh, your mother is so fantastic. And that's another thing that is on the Huffington list. It says, put your partner on a pedestal.
Yes, and talk about that, please.
They talk about a University of Buffalo study that said that viewing your partner with starry eyes may be the key to preserving marital happiness. They asked 220 couples to rank their partner and themselves over time, and those who overinflated their partner's characteristics were more likely to stay in a blissful union. So even if your guy's not perfect, thinking that he's perfect or convincing yourself that he's perfect or at least telling him that he's perfect, you know, maybe a smart move.
Maybe the word isn't necessarily perfect, but just appreciated.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah, because very few of us are perfect. But I think that when couples can start to appreciate each other more and more, it makes a big difference. Love this about you. I so appreciate this about you, and I value this about you. And when couples can say, before they go to sleep at night, say three appreciations, it can make a huge difference in their relationships, in their marriage or their partnership, right?
I think you're totally right.
Yeah.
Another thing, speaking...
Yes, go ahead.
Well, speaking of speaking, just the phraseology you use can be really important, and this is right off of the Huffington list too. You know,
right.
they say saying "I love you" is great, but "we love us" is even better. And then they talk about a Cal Berkeley study that says that couples who use the words "we" and "us," especially during conflicts, but just in general, they have less stress from those arguments compared to couples that use words like "I," "me," "you." They say that using individual pronouns was linked to having an unhappy marriage. Using dual pronouns is linked to having a positive marriage.
I believe it. I believe it. And some of my work with couples involves coaching them with fair fighting and word usage and back and forth. And certainly that's very true. What about the last point in the Huffington thing, doing things that you both enjoy?
Yeah, I think they've got a good point there, too. And this comes out of the Journal of Marriage and Family Counseling, and it says that sharing activities that one partner strongly dislikes decreases marital happiness. I mean, you force your spouse to go skiing and they hate the cold. They obviously suggest that couples find activities they both enjoy, and that obviously increases long-term marriages. And, you know, those are both kind of no-brainers. But the interesting conclusion was that it's less important that the two of you share the same activities than that you both are participating in hobbies that you actually enjoy, whether it's together or separately. So staying active, trying to think of things that both enjoy, or failing that, let each go on their own as far as the activity stuff that they like, and being supportive of that obviously increases marital happiness or relationship happiness. So I think, and especially, you know, as you know, one of the big transitions that people have got to make, you know, the two big things that I see as a divorce lawyer,
yeah,
that are two junctures for people coming in and singing the blues and filing for divorce,
yeah,
is the first year after the last child leaves home.
Right.
Which, when you think about it, that's a classic because, you know, everything's been focused to date on the kids, and then all of a sudden they're gone, and you're sitting there staring at each other going, okay, you know,
exactly.
Now what do we have left in common? And the other time is when you start retiring, and the career that used to be the focus of everything goes away, and you got to start thinking of things that you can enjoy together.
Yeah.
You know, very important to set that up right. People are living so damn long nowadays that it, you know, you got a long way to go. You know, if you live to 65, you got every likelihood you're going to live to 85 in today's society, and women longer than guys. So, you know, you got to prepare for that last 30 of your life together, last quarter, 30 of your life together. And
yes.
I'm not sure enough people really figure that one out either.
I'm not sure either. That's right. We've got to stop a little. Oh, that music came on a little early. Maybe it's not so sure we need to stop quite yet, but the statistics are that, and you talk about statistics a lot, more than half of all marriages in the U.S. now end in divorce. Oh, it is the music. All right. So, but marriage isn't in worse shape today than it was 100 years ago because we didn't live as long, right?
That's right. That's so, exactly right.
Well, Brad, I'll be in touch with you off the air, and because I want to have you back. I always want to have you back.
I love coming back. Just let me know. I'd be happy to come back on, and aloha to all your listeners. I hope people learn something out of this and enjoy it. Feedback is always welcome.
I'm sure that they did, and you're one of my all-time favorite guests, Bradley. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and aloha, everybody.
Aloha, everybody. Yeah. Don't a lot of us wish we were in Hawaii where we could really say it with absolute smile, saying, oh, I'm in paradise. Well, with a little more love, lust, and laughter in your life, you can be in paradise. Thank you again, Bradley. We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.